Today is Friday, January 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the shutdown battle between President Trump and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi is turning into a game of brinksmanship. The father of an American man killed in this week's Nairobi attack talks about the son he has lost.
As someone that I love people, I love this family, that always look for the best in everybody.
Top North Korean officials are in the U.S. for high-level talks. Also ahead, a rap star superstar starts trending on social media. Well, the U.S. government shutdown now going into a 28th day with no end in sight as President Trump and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi try to one-up each other. The shutdown standoff revolves around the president's campaign promise to build a wall on the U.S. southern border with Mexico and Democrats' refusal to agree to the funding for building it. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani has the latest.
The president has not said whether he'll postpone the speech, but he is postponing Pelosi's trip to visit troops in Afghanistan and Brussels, denying her use of a military aircraft for a trip he calls a public relations event. The Pentagon says he does have the authority to do that. Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff says he shouldn't have used it.
All too often in the last 2 years, the president has acted like he's in the fifth grade.
GOP Trump ally Lindsey Graham calls the president's decision inappropriate. But top House Republican Kevin McCarthy says Pelosi gets the blame here.
Being Speaker of the House and leaving the country when it's shut down, I don't think that's appropriate.
The White House says it wants Pelosi in town to work on ending the nation's longest shutdown. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Well, a new report by the government or by government investigators says the Department of Health and Human Services doesn't actually know how many migrant children were separated from their parents and taken into U.S. custody. As we continue talking about immigration and the border wall, AP correspondent Jennifer King has that part of the story.
Government investigators who conducted a federal audit found that thousands more migrant children may have been separated from their families than the administration has previously acknowledged. Ann Maxwell's with the Office of the Inspector General at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
More children over a longer period of time were separated by immigration authorities and referred to HHS for care than is commonly discussed in the public debate. How many more children were separated is unknown.
The watchdog's report found ongoing problems keeping track of the children.
There is no existing integrated database.
Because of a court order last year, we know that at least 2,700 children were involved. Now government investigators say we don't really know how many migrant children may have been separated from their families. Jennifer King, Washington.
Well, the president is arguing there is an urgent crisis involving illegal immigration. Amnesty International is calling on the Trump administration to stop what it says is dehumanizing asylum seekers. They argue the proposed wall is nothing more than a divisive symbol of fear and shouldn't be funded. Joining us to discuss their policy is Amnesty International researcher Justin Mazzola.
Basically, this has been happening for 2 years now. We've had researchers shortly after President Trump issued his executive order on border enforcement, I think within a week or two after he was inaugurated in January 2017, we had researchers on the ground in the border to basically get a pre-assessment of what the border conditions were like in anticipation of them getting worse as the administration moved through the following years. And even at that early stage in February and March of 2017, we were already seeing and hearing reports of people, basically either families or unaccompanied children, presenting themselves at these ports of entry to seek asylum, as they had been done for decades now, whether they were fleeing violence during the 80s in Central America or more recently with the instability in some of these Central American countries for the past, like I said, 4 or 5 years now, seeing these flows of unaccompanied children and families. And what they've basically been facing is that, you know, Border Patrol agents have been telling them that either they can't apply for asylum at all, it's not eligible to them, or basically telling them that they're not eligible without ever actually interviewing them, or telling them to come back at another time. And, you know, that's definitely progressed over the last 2 years to basically this metering system where, you know, they're only allowing through a trickle of asylum seekers each day and blaming capacity in facilities near the border, CBP facilities near the border, where usually individuals are just held for about 72 hours at most before they're either transferred or released. And what we're seeing is basically this trickle. And what that has is a knockdown effect all across the border. You have families and children who are then waiting for weeks, if not months, basically to access. And the crowds and the groups on the other side, especially when we have these larger groups of individuals like the caravans that we saw right before the November elections, when you have people who are traveling in mass for their own safety because of issues in Mexico, end up at the border and then basically have nowhere to go because immigration officials and border patrol officials are basically just saying you can't come in and basically slowing the process to a crawl. So it's a manufactured crisis that he has created through not even overt policies, but basically by shutting down ways to enter legally through the ports of entry. And what that does is people who get desperate, they have no other choice but to then travel inland and away from the ports of entry and try to cross where there is no barriers. And as we've been seeing, you know, it's not that these people are largely groups of, you know, single men who are looking for, you know, employment and are trying to evade border patrol. We're seeing the exact opposite. It's mostly families and children who, as soon as they cross the border, are basically seeking out border patrol so that they can seek asylum and seek protection.
The president seems to really be digging in. He's calling this a crisis. He's saying we need the wall. Nothing else will work to solve the problem of people entering the country illegally. Would a wall do anything?
In the regular circumstances of most individuals, it would just make their journey more harder and mm-hmm. more difficult and more treacherous and put more people at risk. We've seen this policy from the U.S. government in some form or fashion. It was a policy previously in the 1990s that was developed that placed the fencing that we have now in the San Diego sector as well as in the Texas areas, where basically they put fencing in certain areas that still exists that were basically driving people away from areas just outside of ports of entries, and we're driving them more towards more treacherous terrain. And you're out there for days, if not an extended period of time, without access to water, without access to facilities where individuals become dehydrated. And what we've seen is a mass increase of people dying trying to cross to the Sonoran Desert. A wall will basically just make things even worse. Desperate people will do anything that they possibly can when their lives are in danger. It's something that we know and have seen for decades and have documented.
Do you have any final statement as far as policy regarding asylum seekers?
Seeking asylum is a legal right. He keeps complaining about people coming in and jumping the line and that this is illegal immigration. Asylum is a legal pathway to immigrating into the United States, and the U.S. has certain obligations that it must keep, both in international law with treaties it signed at the international level, as well as with its domestic law and U.S. constitutional law with regards to providing protection who are seeking it. The U.S. administration must abide by those and provide protection for those who are seeking it. All these policies that are being put in place to discourage what is legal immigration of people seeking protection and asylum need to be seen for what they truly are. It's just xenophobic rhetoric that appeals to the worst instincts. These are people who are leaving places where their lives are at threat and are seeking protection. They're facing violence and insecurity in their home countries and are looking for a way to live in a safe community, which they can't find in their homes.
That's Amnesty International researcher Justin Mazzola. One of America's closest European allies is facing a crisis of its own after surviving a no-confidence vote on Wednesday in the UK. British Prime Minister Theresa May is now focusing on getting a Brexit deal through Parliament. She has until Monday to offer a new proposal to the House of Commons. Ambassador Charles Rees, Vice President and International at the RAND Corporation, talked to us about what options the UK has regarding to Brexit or not to Brexit?
Well, one option is a referendum. You know, one option that might command that 350 or so members of parliament might be a new referendum on that would be specific. It would be we stay in or we crash out. since no one likes the withdrawal agreement with the backstop and all the other elements that seem to tie the UK to the EU forever but without any voting rights. That's a simple choice, and Europeans now know what it means. If that is the option that commands a majority of parliament, then the Europeans would be happy to give them more time to put on such a referendum, and if a majority of the British people vote to stay in, then they would stay in.
So what happens next?
Well, we'll see. The next couple of days through next Monday. Next Monday is when the Prime Minister is required to sort of say what she wants to do, the so-called Plan B. And that may give an indication as to whether or not she's going to try to come up with another concept for a negotiated withdrawal or a new referendum, or just let it go to a withdrawal without an agreement and adopt, if you will, measures that reduce the pain of the immediate crash out.
I understand there's a lot of money involved in this whole deal. It's not just leaving the EU. There's a financial component to all of this.
That's right. The withdrawal agreement has been compared to a divorce. And in a divorce, there is what you do with the children and what your relationship is going to be in the future. But importantly, in a divorce, there's a financial settlement. And there are a wide variety of British obligations to the other members of the EU. There are projects, infrastructure projects around Europe that were agreed to as EU commitments that are only now just starting or not finished. There are pension obligations for British citizens who work for the European Commission and other European institutions. And all told, that is sums up to maybe 40 billion pounds sterling in present value, and would continue over a period of years. If the British withdrawal agreement is actually not agreed to, which the Parliament actually defeated earlier this week, the British are not obligated to make those payments, and that would be a very big hole in the EU's budget, on top of the fact that in the next 7-year EU budget, the UK is assumed not to be a member. And so for countries on the periphery of Europe that depend on European transfers, like Bulgaria or Greece or Slovakia, there are projects that have a financial hole, and that's important to the Europeans and makes them very interested in what's happening in London today.
All right, that's Ambassador Charles Rees, Vice President International at the RAND Corporation. We very much appreciate your perspective. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The 9/11 survivor dies in the Kenya terror attack. Trump unveils a space-based missile defense strategy. A Canadian kidnapped in Burkina Faso has been found dead. And an ex-Trump lawyer apparently paid a man to rig online polls. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. As the investigation continues into Tuesday's terrorist attack in Nairobi, the world is remembering the 21 people confirmed dead, among them an American survivor of the 9/11 attack, two inseparable Kenyan cousins, and a British citizen. With more, we turn to Reuters reporter Michelle Hennessy.
As Kenya reels from a deadly 20-hour siege, details of the victims have begun to emerge. Among them, British national Luke Potter and US citizen Jason Spindler. So far, two Kenyans have been named. Cousins Abdullah Dahir and Faisal Ahmed were described by relatives as inseparable. Their bodies were laid to rest at a joint funeral on Wednesday. Ahmed's wife is 7 months pregnant. They were having lunch together when the suicide bomber struck on Tuesday. Both Abdullah and Ahmed worked on economic programs trying to improve their life in neighboring Somalia, home to the militant group that claimed responsibility for the attack. Al-Shabaab is an al-Qaeda affiliate that has carried out a number of attacks in the East African nation, which it calls revenge for Kenyan troops stationed inside Somalia, a country that's been torn apart by an ongoing civil war for nearly 30 years. But in the group's two-page statement on this latest attack, it states US President Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital as a motive for the siege. Asked about the group's claim, a White House National Security Council spokesman said in a statement, "This senseless act is a stark reminder of why the United States remains resolved in our fight to defeat radical Islamist terrorism." Airstrikes against the group have intensified under Trump, but Tuesday's attack showed the insurgents are still capable of striking outside Somalia's borders.
You'll be okay, yeah?
Gunshots and blasts continued to ring out in the capital for 20 hours. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta announced the end of the siege on Wednesday and that all militants had been killed. CCTV clips showed at least five people were involved in the attack in the upscale complex. Dozens of people remain unaccounted for, raising the possibility of a much higher death toll.
Meanwhile, the American man killed in the attack would have turned 41 next week. Jason Spindler's grieving father, Joseph Spindler, spoke through tears to VOA Africa reporter Solomon and says his son was above all a humanitarian.
Jason was an all-American young kid. He went to school in Houston. You know, he was born in Houston, Texas. He went to school in Houston. High school, went to Hebron Academy in Maine, but college, he went to University of Texas in Austin. Graduated with a business degree and an astronomy degree, cum laude. He was the type of guy that if you met him, you knew he was destined for greatness. He had a smile that was totally captivating and infectious. He had a personality that was overwhelming. Everybody loved him. Everybody felt very close to him at once. He always looked at the good in people, always saw the good, and he always tried to help people. From the University of UT, he went to work on Wall Street. With Salman Smith Barney at the time. And he was doing very well, destined to a good career in Wall Street. And he decided that that's not where his calling was. And he told us that he wanted to go into the Peace Corps, which he did. And he was stationed in Peru. While he was in Peru, he brought his Wall Street expertise and help developing farmers to have a cooperative, to have a consistent production of goods and be able to send those products into the international market.
What were some of his favorite things, would you say?
Well, his favorite things was really being with people. He loved his friends. He loved rock climbing. He loved music. He was a swimmer. He used to swim at the University of Texas and was also on the water polo team. He was a people's individual. Mm-hmm. We've had calls from people that said, "I met your son 10 years ago, and he changed my life. I'm a totally different person because of him." He was that type of guy. When you met him, you knew he was destined for greatness and that he was going to make a name for himself. Mm-hmm. He was a hard worker. He worked hard and he played hard. Mm-hmm. And he kept in touch with every single person he met. He had a very large following. I'm amazed at all the people in the world that are contacting us about him.
You were in your work at work when you heard the news?
Well, you know, I looked at the morning news and I saw it, and I was a little bit worried because at the hotel we have stayed there before when we go visit him, and his office is in the same complex. So I knew that very often he would go to the garden restaurant and eat lunch and work there. Tried calling him, we got no answer. You know, I was told that he left his phone at work. That's why you're not getting any answer from them. I tried reaching the embassy, and they didn't know anything. I tried speaking to the police department, and they wouldn't give out any information. Mm-hmm. And I kept getting conflicting reports from people. Some said he was okay, some said we don't know. But his friends there were wonderful. They went to every single hospital with his picture. They stopped every single ambulance. They were looking for him. And we hadn't heard from him, and we hadn't heard from him. And I knew that, you know, after 3, 4, 5 hours, not hearing from him, something drastically was wrong. And then eventually I got the call from the embassy, the consulate, telling him that his body had been identified.
Mm-hmm. I'm so sorry that I have to make you relive, but I really want to make sure that his story is told. So we've seen reports that he was affected by the 9/11 attack. Can you tell us about that? And was he in the World Trade Center? How?
Yeah, when he worked for Thomas and Barney, they worked at the Building 7. And that day, he just happened to stay at a friend's house in Brooklyn. So he was late to work. And when he came out of the subway is when the tower collapsed. So he was, covered in dust and all of that. He went back the next day to try to help, and that's when the Building 7 came down. Yeah, he was, if he wouldn't have stayed at a friend's house in Brooklyn, he would have been in there.
How would you like him to be remembered?
As a humanitarian, as someone that they loved people, they loved his family. They always look for the best in everybody.
All right, that's Joseph Spindler, father of Jason Spindler, an American killed this week in the attack in Nairobi, Kenya, speaking to VOA Africa's Selim Solomon. A North Korean envoy arrived in Washington Thursday for expected talks with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and a possible encounter with President Trump. Trump visit is aimed at laying the groundwork for a second U.S.-North Korea summit. The envoy arrived on the same day Trump unveiled a revamped U.S. missile defense strategy that singled out North Korea as an ongoing and extraordinary threat, 7 months after he declared, after his first summit with leader Kim Jong-un, that the North Korean threat had been eliminated.
We have some very bad players out there, and we're a good player. But we can be far worse than anybody.
Kim Jong-chol, Pyongyang's lead negotiator in denuclearization talks with the U.S., is due to meet Pompeo and could also go to the White House later today, a sign of potential movement in a diplomatic effort that has appeared stalled for months. The North Korean visit could yield an announcement of plans for another summit between Trump and Kim Jong-un, according to sources familiar with the talks. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Voices, we're talking about the news and issues you're talking about,
sharing stories of development and growth across Africa, around the world, and in our lives. Topics that inform, empower,
and change the rules.
It's time for Our Voices
with me, Heidi Adams Fitzpatrick,
and Hadiza Kiari,
and Ayan Bior,
and Orion Itangi Shaka.
Join us on Facebook at VOA Our Voices.
It's time for Our Voices.
VOA's International Edition continues. Ghana produces about 900,000 metric tons of cocoa every year. This makes it the world's second biggest exporter of the magic bean, second only behind Ivory Coast. Until recently, most of that cocoa went straight out of Ghana, but today local farmers want to keep it at home. Arash Arabasadi reports.
Chances are good that if you've ever had cocoa or chocolate, it came from one of the 900,000 or so cocoa farming families in Ghana. Farmers like Nicholas Narwarty say that instead of exporting their cocoa, farmers should be making their own chocolates.
We should be adding value locally to the cocoa. If demand increased locally, that would only help us. It would be better to produce the chocolate locally rather than exporting the beans.
Ghana is the world's second biggest cocoa exporter. But for farmers sending the raw cocoa overseas, the fruits of their labor are not as lucrative as making and selling their own chocolate.
The confectionery business has started on a humble note of approximately 2 to 5% of our output to start with. But we believe that the confectionery business or the confectionery section is the way to go. Basically, talking about value addition. So we know that that is going to grow.
Niche is Ghana's leading chocolate exporter, distributing about 60 tons of semi-processed beans each year. The company started making its own chocolates in 2017. They now make 200 tons of finished chocolate goods each year, and that number is on the rise thanks in part to government help.
Any import you bring in, that's machinery, equipment, whatever, you don't pay any tax on them. No import tax on them. Number two, you have 10 years moratorium for corporate tax.
But that really only helps large companies able to purchase machinery. The majority of Ghana's artisanal chocolate producers get zero government support and often operate in parts of the country without reliable electricity, which may for now leave small farmers still looking to export their crop outside of Ghana. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
NASA says they are getting closer to resuming science operations with the Hubble Space Telescope's Wide Field Camera 3 after restoring it to its operations mode. As a safety precaution, the Hubble camera suspended operation after a hardware problem was detected on January 8th. The space agency says that their technicians are now calibrating the instrument and putting it through a number of tests. The tests are successful. NASA says the camera could be back at work, collecting celestial images within days. The Wide Field Camera 3 was installed on the Hubble by crew members of the Space Shuttle Atlantis in 2009. It replaced two original Hubble Wide Field cameras and was touted to be the most technologically advanced instrument to take images that can be seen with the human eye. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Look, it's all bad, it's all real. I ride in some big tall hills, big fat checks, big large bills. Run out, flip like 10 car wheels. Cold. I give raw chills, 10 different looks, and my lips okay.
Well, as the U.S. government shutdown drags on with federal employees facing another missed paycheck, the voices speaking out are getting louder. And one of them is rapper Cardi B, who's getting praise on social media for a video she posted on Instagram expressing her anger about what's happening.
Hey, y'all, I just want to remind y'all, because it's been a little bit over 3 weeks, okay? Trump is now ordering, as in summoning, federal government workers to go back to work without getting paid. Now, I know a lot of y'all don't care because y'all don't work for the government or y'all probably don't even have a job. Like, our country is in a hellhole right now.
Well, she was referring to the news the Trump administration has ordered 50,000 government employees back to work without pay. Many of those recalled work on things like ensuring the safety of food and drugs, air travel, and tax returns. Well, you've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Carl Starling. I'm Lori London. Thanks so much. Have a great day. Get a little bag and take it to the store. Money. Get a little cash. Money. You shake it real fast, you get a little more. Money. I got bands in the coop. Busting out the roof. I got bands in the coop. Touch me out.
No, Papa, you pop. Call Papa whoever. You know who popped the most? The people who shit not together.
Okay.
You know that Cardi a freak. All my pajamas is leather. So black on your wear. Wakanda forever. Sweet like a honey bun. Spit like a tummy gun. Roll your one and one. Come get your mommy some Cardi. Get the tip top. Kiss the ring and kick rocks, sis. Jump it down, back it up. Ooh, ayy. Hey. Make that nigga in 2K. I like my first like Deuce. He gonna eat this like soup. I was born to flex. Diamonds on my neck. I like boarding jets. I like money. But nothing in this world that I like more than culture. All I really wanna see is the
money.
I don't really need a D, I need the
money.
All a bad need is a
KKC.
This is VOA News.